there is no agenda. I mean, I will start talking and then you will all continue. I just wanted to point out a couple of things that didn't come up yesterday. First of all, we have the opportunity to bring in external speakers. By opportunity, I mean. And so if there's somebody who's not on the agenda, or is on the agenda, or not on the list of people who are participating, or who is on the list but for much later on, and you want to hear from them, we can invite them and bring them here, have them stay for a couple of days. One person, for example, would be Sarvani, who can no longer participate here, but might be able to make it for a few days. Other people, I mean, just think of whoever you can think of within a reasonable distance, and we can bring them in for a couple of days, which is kind of a nice opportunity.
Sarvani is not coming at all?
She'll be here for the conference, but we have to cancel her other plan. But we are hoping to bring her in for some time within her. So suggestions right away, right off the bat.
What is a reasonable distance?
I don't know. So let's not worry about that for now, and then we'll worry about it later. It sounded like you had somebody in mind who was perhaps unreasonably far away.
Well, I'm not sure if he's actually doing, he's not doing astroseismology stuff, but the head of the department in Nijmegen, he's actually having a sabbatical at Caltech.
Oh, that's close.
So that's not far, right?
Yeah.
He works on compact binaries, Paul Coit.
Oh, sure.
He works on compact binaries, but from the observational point.
Good. I like binaries, as do others on the table. Other suggestions? Caltech, obviously there are a few people there that might be of interest, Stanford as well, on the solar side.
If you're interested in binaries, we can also find Kaisen,
Volker, who was in that
mark, now he's in Canada.
Okay.
Victoria.
Okay, so just...
Yeah. Okay.
What's his last name?
Working with Volker, Bjork, or...
Actually, why don't I write these names up here, so this way they're semi-permanent.
Could you just pop that off? The red button once, and then...
Mike, and how do I raise the screen? Oh, wait, it is simple.
Spelled right?
Yeah.
Okay.
E-R-O-G-A-A-R-D.
Okay. Good. Other folks you want to bring in?
I'll write down one.
She's a finishing up PhD student at Caltech who's been looking at M dwarfs and brown dwarfs for very long. As you can tell, I'm interested in M dwarf and brown dwarf variability these days. Other folks that you want to bring in?
David Soderblom, Space Telescope.
Okay. Actually, I shouldn't number these. So that implies some sort of order.
To know. Steve's got
something there. No, like,
no.
There's two chairs.
No.
Yeah, you can sit in one.
There's no assigned seats, despite the fact that everybody came and sat pretty much where they sat yesterday. We're just brainstorming on people that we might want to bring in for a couple of days. Good call.
I'm meeting my people from Europe.
We can invite a few people from Europe. Okay. Yes. Especially if they're going to be here anyway for some reason or another, you know, we can contact them and say, are you going to be in the U.S. and you're this fall? If so, consider visiting. There's also people in Canada that do astroseismology. Mm-hmm. Might be interested in visiting.
Well, logical is first to determine what we want to achieve.
Yeah.
depending on something.
That's good. Yeah. There's utility there.
But if anybody has a burning desire to read something.
Yes.
Well, I don't know this man personally. I also don't know his first name, actually, Michel. I'm very interested in this.
Ah, George Michel.
Yes.
Yeah, I've never met him, but.
He's still at Montreal, I
Yeah, but he's retired now, so but.
Well, then he has plenty of
Well, for someone from Montreal who's not retired, who would have something very interesting to say, I think Suzanne Tallon.
You can invite Pierre Olivier also.
Yes. He's also in Montreal. Why don't we just invite everybody from Montreal? There are a few people there that are really interested.
To bring the food with them.
Who did I not write down? I heard some other names.
I tried already, so.
Try again.
Well, it doesn't have to come from you. Can just come for a couple of days, enjoy the scenery, give a talk.
Ask him.
Tell him that bicycle riding here is excellent.
Okay. Richard. He probably knows that.
Has he been here with his bicycle?
No, but he goes quite often to Tucson, for instance.
Ah.
Yeah. Well,
we can discuss this.
Yeah.
All right, so these are some names.
We can invite Mike Thompson.
Michael will be here for the conference, and I might punch him in the nose if he comes in. So.
Are you sure he's going to be on?
Yeah. Okay. I'll let you check on it.
All right. Good.
I can't keep thinking of names. Actually, it's probably on the webcam. It'll be on the website, which means Anne Marie's going to look at this and say, "What? It's my name on the board." Okay. Good. I keep thinking of folks. Now, Matteo suggested we discuss our priorities, which is an excellent thing that we should do. So why don't we do that next?
What do you want to do? We've got 11 weeks and 3 days left.
Yeah, maybe we should let that to Wiki. It's raining.
11 weeks, 3 and a half days left. Oh, you can't count that?
Yeah.
You ever watch the TV show The One? To the end of their administration and things they wanted to get done, which wouldn't be a terrible idea.
So what do you want to get done?
Well, from my point of view, of course, you know, I don't know that much about astrophysiology, so one aim for me is to learn, but definitely as a practical focus on something we want to achieve at the end, most interesting thing that astrophysiology is promising to deliver is a way to test some of the internal mixing processes that, for example, are so important for the evolution of the star I'm mostly interested into, massive stars. And in that case, for example, the degree of traditional mixing occurring in the inner layer for some convection, for example, at the boundary of the conductive burning region is extremely important. So if it's possible to start having data to constrain and, you know, disentangle some of these degenerate, at least from the point of view of surface abundances, be very important. And that's something I'm very really interested in. Of course, you know, there's been a lot of, there is still a lot of work going on, and the most recent results are quite dramatic in terms of, for example, of the accepted theory of, for example, rotational mixing, which has been very successful in the last 10, 15 years to try to explain some of the properties of O and B stars, but that seem to fail in reproducing basic properties of main sequence stars. This is a result from the recent work from the VLD flame spaceship, where, the, for example, the nitrogen enrichment at the surface of main sequence stars cannot be fully explained by models that include all the updated physics we believe is important for the evolution of these stars. Only the main sequence I'm talking about.
Didn't Madeira and Manet rebut the claim that the balances were inconsistent with that model?
Yeah, he was a bit critical on it, but I think he has to admit that when you take this sample of stars, there are stars which clearly do not fit the interpretation. So it's possible to bring it. So there are two possibilities. Either the whole theory of additional mixing as we know it is not correct, is a possibility. Or there are other phenomena which occur in a fraction of, important fraction of the stars, which we don't understand. So both cases, it's new physics problem. Mm-hmm. So there are two problems. One is the calibration, of course, but also missing physics. And of course, astrophysics cosmology can come very much in hand at this point, because it's the only way to, you know, believe probably a greater degeneracy in some of these cases.
Well, we will have people here. I mean, we have people here now interested in that, obviously, but we will have people coming who have worked actively in that area. Right. We'll have Mark Pinsonall a little bit later. Sylvie Beauclair will be here. Pascal Garot is coming. That's another person we should invite for a short-term visit. She was going to be a participant, but her teaching load is fairly high this term.
Right. I see that there are a lot of persons which are involved into intermixing. Mostly they're focusing on mixing process occurring in coma stars, which is okay. I'm interested in those two. There's a bit of an imbalance. I understand that usually this community, astrophysiology, has been mostly focused on coma stars, you know, and it's clearly the way to go because it's more data, I guess. It's more easy. But there's a great stuff coming up also for the massive one, which is definitely interesting. So I guess this might, in terms of physics, might be useful at some point to ask somebody else.
And I think if you want somebody to discuss the sort of observational underpinnings of this discrepancy, then Danny Lennon is a space telescope.
Yeah, Lennon is definitely.
And he was one of the people on the flames.
Yeah.
What's his last name?
Lennon. Oh, he's part of our collaboration.
Yes, I know. Lennon.
Same as John.
Right, no relation.
No relation.
And yeah, definitely. And then, you know, if you want, I think Norbert Langer was invited, has been invited. I'm not sure if we'll make it.
Check the speaker list for the conference. We have some, at least one person coming. We did invite George Renee, but I don't think he can. But if you go to the conference, then. Is that the list of people coming to the conference? That's participants in this program. So if you go to the...
It should be that as well, because they're there for the week of the conference.
Okay.
So...
And Mark can probably guess pretty much anything.
Yeah.
But then you're getting a singular view. So who do we have on massive stars?
Well, Stan is going to come, but he's a bit more interested in the other ladies.
Yeah,
I guess
he might know about the... Well, no, I wouldn't say he doesn't know anything about it, but he's not
going to be... He wouldn't claim himself to be an authority.
No, no.
That's Stan O'Walkie. Massive star witnesses.
Yeah,
so we don't have anybody coming
from the conference? I can ask again, Norbert, if he's planning to come from the conference. Mm-hmm. I don't know what was the last. He's last down on that.
Okay.
He could not commit that early when he was asked for. That's why he has no talk. But he might in the end come. I'm not sure. I will ask him. Danny would be an easier bet because he will only have to come from the East Coast because he's the first. He could just come for a few days. And he's going to teach me. So I think that might be a good person to involve. He's aware of both, as Rich mentioned, the observational side, and he's involved with the theoretical side in the collaboration. Good, no, what's been going on.
Okay, so we've got, clearly we'll be discussing mixing around here, but your concern is stars above two solar masses.
Well, you know, mixing in general, you know, yes, I'm interested in movie stars like eight.
Anything
else?
Yeah. Anything at all?
Anything that has called collapse?
Well, right, you know, it would be great if we could come up with this meeting having a roadmap, which, you know, I think that the impression I had when I, from the NASA STAR community, was that, you know, astroseismology has been promising for a long time, you know, and, you know, from a theoretical point of view, it's very powerful, but then there's never really a contact with a prediction, or at least a contact with the possibility of creating like a quantitative estimate of these things. But now it seems like we're getting there, I understand, with the new observation, with the new facilities.
Right. So, you know, if we're moving across the table.
Right, so I'm close with it. I see that incredible stuff has been done in robots. And so, it's true that for mass star, maybe I have less observation, I have less objects, and I'm more complicated than other.
It's really this.
Right. There's also the fact that we know so much less about this stuff. You know, we don't understand the main sequence of this stuff. So anything coming out quantitatively is going to be extremely important and very well received by it.
Who do we have doing beta sets and SPV stars? Today Anne is here, but who is coming?
Oh, who's coming? Marc-Antoine is coming only for the conference.
Yeah,
okay. Tony is coming. Peter de Boer, who's working with him.
Yeah.
Who is working? And he's more on the observation side, but.
Well, what Mateo is looking for is that connection.
Yeah.
And then the best we can do at the moment are the beta sets and slowly pulsating these stars. I mean, nothing in the O star.
The massive star community tends to ignore that at least the SPV stars because their masses are too low. But fundamentally, it's exactly the same physics. It's
exactly.
A convective core and radiative envelope, so there's no good reason that they should be ignored.
That's right.
We have great new results from for O stars that we have grad students who just presented her passed her PhD thesis last week in our group, and she has very nice results. Maybe because, I mean, she's coming from Belgium, so that's a bit expensive. But
how long could she have for?
I don't know.
She's just passed, and she started her postdoc.
Yeah, but she hasn't. She's still at the University of Liège. She hasn't.
Okay. These are new results from real stars compared to what you've got so far.
I mean, she just presented her results, and I'm going to talk about them at the conference. But she introduced semi-convection in the evolution code, and she shows that it's how the frequencies she produces with the code now reproduce the observed ones with the semi-convection. Input and
what's her name?
Mélanie Godard.
As in Robert Goddard?
G-O-D-A-R-T.
Oh, Godard.
Melanie.
Melanie. M-E-L-A. Oh, Melanie. Yeah. Melanie. You gotta pronounce it with a nice last. No one needs to go back.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. If she's still a student, technically is still a student, then bringing her here as an affiliate is easy. If she's a PhD, then bringing her here as a participant, if she's willing and able, might still be possible.
Yeah,
Presumably,
she just passed her thesis, so I don't know when her status changes from student to postgrad.
Probably
right now, so.
So she does O stars.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move along to other themes. I mean, that clearly is a nice
packet. I wanted to, yes, you had the remark on binaries.
Yes.
And for,
that would be
I would try to say, and try to focus on the fact that those stars actually, recently we found that in most clusters, these stars have a binary fraction, which is as high as real binary fraction, that's almost 70%. So basically, single stars probably don't even exist in this master chain.
Sounds like the SVGs.
Yes. So, you know, we have to always keep that in mind every master star. Interesting thing is that the orbital separation is that such that they're all going to be in, so most of them, not all, like 80% of them, all these binaries, which are already big fraction, going to be interacting before the end of the main sequence. Every time you look at the main sequence star, the chance
in the main sequence.
Yeah. So the chance that this star is going to be interacting or has already interacted is very, very high.
Now, is that simply conservative evolution, or does that include?
This is only this surveys look at you can check the period of this binary. And you know if the binary is in of a massive star, it's in a period less than 10 days, mm-hmm. it's going to interact before the end of the main sequence.
But if, again, is that assuming no angular momentum loss from the stellar winds or anything like that?
It says here there is some angular momentum loss, but during the main sequence, the masses from the wind masses is very small, so it's not going to change much.
Okay.
There is a change in the orbit when mass angular momentum transfer due to mass accretion, correct?
Yeah.
But you know, once in that phase, you're already transferring mass, you're already in
phase
A or B. So,
binaries appear their ugly head. So, one of the themes that I want to pursue, as I mentioned yesterday, is how do we handle binaries? Or in one sense, and then the other sense is what can we learn about binaries? Right? So how do we handle binaries means interaction between orbital energy or orbital angular momentum and oscillations.
So dynamical tides, or more than that?
Well, dynamical tides, yes, but also tidally driven oscillations, right, as opposed to just...
But I mean, that is dynamical tides, isn't it?
That's part of it.
Yeah. Okay.
One is part of the other. Which is really messy, but really exciting. Jean Bolzan is coming, maybe, maybe not. He's had some health issues, but he'll be here at least for the conference. But there are other people coming whose names I don't know off the top of my head that are interested in that sort of thing, in the sense that it's taken over their professional lives. I hope that doesn't happen to me, but it's a very interesting problem. At the same time, though, the traditional single star 1B spherically symmetric astroseismic analysis can teach us about binary. And that's one sort of thread that I'd like to have an ongoing discussion about, and that comes into play in the SDBs, which Stefan has worked on, Ali has worked on, and Stephen has worked on, and I've worked on, where we assume that the oscillations of the SDB star are telling us something about its rotational state and synchronization in binary. With Kepler data, and with the kind of data that we hopefully will continue to get from Kepler and extended mission, we can look at time dependence of those effects, actually, in the non-synchronized binaries, look for motion towards synchronization by looking at the time dependence of rotational state. These sorts of observations are becoming available, and we need theoretical tools to make predictions as to what we're expecting to see, and so on. So there's the SDB binary, the massive star binary. I've just learned 30 seconds ago, we might be able to do the same sort of thing. And so Astro's seismic probes of binaries is a very interesting area. So it's got its own working group within Kepler, represented by mostly Stephen here. And that's one thread of discussion that I want to keep going. I'll share with other two. One area, two aspects that I'd like to play with.
The reason I suggested Dave Sadovlon is for his expertise in the ages of stars. Right? He wrote this recent annual reviews paper and hosted a conference a year or so ago at Space Telescope. And I think for low mass stars, particularly the potential for, it's already clear that there's a lot of potential for very precise astroseismic ages, and the big question mark that's sort of hanging over that is how accurate are these ages?
I was waiting for that.
Yeah.
They are very precise.
and so there are huge, lots of different areas of uncertainty related to the interior evolution of the star that we need to quantify. It can potentially systematically bias these ages in one direction or the other, but this connects to the broader stellar astrophysics community. I mean, determining the ages for isolated solar type stars is something that people are very excited about, but if they're not any more accurate than the existing methods for doing that, gyrochronology or whatever.
I rolled my eyes at gyrochronology.
It's like creating theoretical error models, right?
Yeah, basically.
But that's complete, I mean, yeah, this is something we've thought about for a while in years, and it's basically impossible in the sense that you obviously don't can quantify the error you make in the physics in your code. Because if you, I mean, you would have to have different physics in codes, in different codes, to be able to create this kind of theoretical error bar. But because the codes, the stellar evolution codes, basically have all the same physics in them, there is no error bar because they all give the same result. Basically, we've done that a few years ago. We compared the Liège evolution code with the Cézanne evolution code, and also I think the Toulouse evolution code. I mean, several different evolution codes, and basically they all get the same results because they have the same physics inside. So you have to change the physics, but we don't have
uncertainty in the physics. Then you can quantify that, right?
How?
Like no, to change parameters that...
No, because you always put the same physics. Right.
But if you've got mixing length theory, you can change the mixing length.
Yeah, but yeah, that's
but,
not...
But you're only going along the surface of like higher motion parameters.
There's physics and then there's physics. I mean, there's physics like the atomic physics reactor rate and so on, which I think we can all agree on are fairly well...
And those we can get error bars on. But then
that's right, but then there's the not-so-physics-y right. Physics like turbulence.
Mixing... The theory, I mean, even the assuming the spherical symmetry, all of that. I mean, all the codes do the same thing, and so you can't quantify the error. So the
and then we don't have the physics understanding to figure out how to vary parameters.
Right.
Yeah, you can vary mixing length, but you're still doing mixing.
Yeah.
And I think that there is another source of uncertainty, which is hard to quantify, is the and it's not related to the models. But you will have to talk to Sylvie Beauclerc about that because she's quite interested in that at the moment. It's the amount of helium in the envelope of the main sequence stars which cannot be observationally measured and which has some impact on actually the age determined from the models. But this is a non-constrained quantity which adds some uncertainty to the situation.
It's true that it cannot be spectroscopically measured, but I don't know that it's true. I mean, it does have an effect on the seismic structure, and so in some sense it's an observable, but indirect.
Yeah, but for a given star, you don't know exactly. You have a degeneracy if you want between two unknowns, the age, and
but maybe that one you can place that parameter and then get some error bar. You can change in your models. You change it.
Instead of getting a point for the age, you get a locus of points in the age plane, which may or may not be useful.
But fundamentally, what you're saying, I mean, there are two types of unknowns: known and unknown. And we can't do anything about the unknown unknowns.
Exactly.
We don't know what we don't know.
Exactly.
But we can make sure that everybody knows what we don't know, right? And then quantify what we don't. What we know, we don't know. Right? Concentrate on those things that we know that we don't know. Right.
In addition to Michaud being retired, Rumsfeld is retired too, so let's talk about the information.
We could even arrest him off Chris Toll.
We could try. All right, so we've got the ages question, which is an interesting one. That ties into binaries, nicely. Because if you've got two stars in a system and you get an astroseismic age from one, then you know it's a physical binary, then you've got extra constraints and you can play. I don't know if you can answer this question in public, but are there Kepler stars that are in binaries where at least one is a solar light pulsator?
Yes, and they're both solar light pulsators.
That's nice. Can you talk about it further in public or not yet?
Yeah, I think so. I just can't tell you which star it is.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. So there are prototypical systems.
Yes,
where you have ways of breaking this degeneracy, unless they alienate plane or something like that.
Yeah.
Unless you have information from two stars of two different masses.
Yeah, and the question is, do you impose that as a constraint, or do you see how far you can get with astroseismology on its own?
You do it both.
You do it both ways, sure. When you just fit the two stars as if they were independent of each other, you end up getting a composition, initial composition and ages for the two stars that are statistically the same. So that gives us a lot of confidence that we're not just
for those two stars.
For those two stars. Although we've done a similar thing for Alpha Centauri A and B, and that also works. The errors are bigger there.
Yeah. Cool. All right, so we have a huge theme. Other themes.
Rotation.
Rotation can be added
to the thing.
Well, okay.
But rotation that goes beyond sort of first or second order perturbation theory and really does non-perturbative rotation with differential rotation and the blameless.
As long as you don't have to worry about oscillations under those conditions, sure.
No, I'm being deadly serious. I'm really interested in, based on all the interest in the solar community about angular momentum transport by stochastically excited waves, I'm interested about what will happen in a massive star when you have actual unstable modes, which have much higher amplitudes than stochastically excited waves. And I've been playing around for a few years with looking at how the high amplitude oscillations can adjust the angular momentum profile of a star. And it seems as though this can happen at timescales that are very short on evolutionary terms, like 10,000 years. And so I'm interested in ultimately developing a set of comprehensive models for this. But the very first stage is to get a robust pulsation code that can handle differential rotation non-perturbatively. And I'm sort of 80% of the way there.
Wait, you said pulsation code?
When I say non-perturbatively, I mean non-perturbative in the sense that we're not treating the rotation as small perturbational oscillations.
Okay,
it's in the whole shebang. There aren't any assumptions that the rotation is a small effect. I'm not throwing out linear theory.
Speaking of linear, Francois Linier is coming.
Ah, okay.
Who will be an interesting person.
Yeah,
I don't know if he'll be older than people overlapping.
I don't know if I'll be able to understand him ever, but he's always very nice company.
And Daniel Reese is coming?
Daniel is coming for at least the conference.
Yeah,
he's coming.
Yeah, I mean, he...
That's why I said...
That crowd of people, though, who's focused mainly on the effect of... mainly sort of more centrifugal effects on the P modes, whereas for the massive stars, especially for the angular momentum transport, it's G modes that are the important mechanism.
They're doing G modes right now.
They're starting to do G modes now?
François Linière, they started looking at G modes, so then.
Yeah.
I would say more about that.
But in the process of trying to develop a code to do this, I just realized that there are quite a lot of unanswered questions about whether we're actually even solving the basic, simplest, adiabatic, non-rotating spherical case in the best way possible, or the fastest way possible, or the most accurate way possible. And so I'm interested in learning about how everybody does it and whether there are ways we can improve on it. So I guess that's a sort of forward modeling theme, just in general. You know, are we using best practices to employ a stupid business euphemism for doing the right thing in doing the forward modeling? What, have I really brought it all down now?
No. Just sign. other themes. So we have, that's actually a mix of things, right? It's a numerical techniques.
On the one hand, yes.
But as applied to a problem for anyone to transport by G-modes and massive stars, kind of science question. So what the hell is that?
And you know, I mean, this will also be important for other G-mode pulsators, which aren't just the massive stars, you know, Gamma Draconis.
So when Corinne Charbonneau worked on this problem for Luna stars, Luna transport by G-modes, I guess.
That's right, yes.
And I think it was, I worked with I think Jean-Paul, if you'd like to come. But I remember this kind of big discussion about this for the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Still going on, I guess. This is the way that you can transport angular momentum in the relative part of the sun, or not. And I think that Douglas Goff was very harsh on this idea.
Douglas Goff being harsh?
Yes. It might be a new thing, but yeah, I didn't like the idea. And I don't remember what it was that he didn't like yet, but I'm just wondering if, you know, what Corinne did was doing exactly what you're trying to do for the massive stars.
There are some differences. I mean, Corinne was assuming that there's some sort of turbulent excitation spectrum of G-modes, and then you work out sort of penetration depths into the radiative zone and how much angular momentum they deposit. Whereas from a so these are all essentially this is adiabatic pulsation theory. Whereas when one's dealing with actual overstable modes that are self-excited rather than stochastically excited, then you've got a full framework for knowing what the growth rates of those modes should be, how their amplitudes will evolve over time. And rather than considering an ensemble of modes with a spectrum, you actually consider a group of individual modes that you know to be linearly unstable, and you allow their amplitudes to evolve over time according to growth rates. And there's no, really, there's no extra physics beyond the non-adiabatic pulsation code that you put in there. You allow the angular momentum flux to update the stellar structure, and then you allow the updated stellar structure to have a feedback effect on the modes.
In your case, apparently, if these are the time scale you find, you're going to find out that the star is rigidly rotating on time.
But funnily enough, you've got angular momentum transport is it's not a diffusion process. It doesn't erase gradients, it creates them. And so for some B-star models, I've found that excitation of M does not equal zero modes leads to the establishment of a shear layer below the surface. It's situated on the iron opacity bump. Basically you get a steep shear in that layer that's caused by the pulsation.
When are we going to get a talk from you?
I could dig out a talk that I gave back in Santa Fe or something that just shows some preliminary results. But since then I've been trying to do things properly. And it's kind of not been...
Okay, so then it could be a blackboard.
Yeah, I guess
it could. Sort of summarize your Santa Fe talk and tell us what's been going on since.
Yeah.
Yes, but.
I could do that.
How about Thursday?
That's fine.
Thursday at 11?
Yep, that's
cool. Okay, you're on the calendar. As soon as I put it on the calendar. So about half an hour and then...
Yeah. Discussion. I mean, and sort of half an hour and then interrupted, you know, just stopping whenever.
Somebody.
Yeah.
Good. Great, because that's something else I wanted to bring up, and that is... We do have this room Tuesdays and Thursdays at 11, and we could have discussions like this every Tuesday, Thursday, 11, which would be a lot of fun. But if we know in advance that the topic will be something, then we can sort of hopefully be a little more prepared. So let's start with you Thursday at 11. Send me a title or just a generic discussion on. And then we can get it up out on the calendar and out to people because this is something that other folks at UCSB might be able to do.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm looking forward to that because I visited Madison in April and Rich showed me just a little bit of what was going on. So I'm anxious to see that in a more formal presentation. Other themes? Other volunteers for seminars? Half hour talks plus discussions over the next 2 weeks or so.
Nobody wants to find that part.
That's Rich, who's already on.
No, yeah, but I've got a suggestion for another theme, but I wouldn't want it to...
No, go ahead.
Mode identification.
Okay.
Both observationally and theoretically, because pulsation codes that do rotation spit out all of these modes, but you don't know what it is. And you've got no way to find out what it is unless you turn down the rotation back to zero, and then you can say, well, it's such and such spherical harmonics, it must be this. But, you know, there's a real... I mean, I was up in Halifax in Nova Scotia early on this year talking to Bob Dupree, who's working on pulsation with rotation, and he was having exactly the same problem. How do you identify modes coming out of codes that where the angular dependence is not a single spherical harmonic?
There was lots of discussion about this in Granada, the solar pulsation meeting a couple weeks ago. Francois was there. He was one of the people that was pointing this out as well. That's a terrific problem. When Francois is here...
When is he here?
When is Francois?
I'm probably going to mess him up.
I'm looking back at the list there. Thank you. So,
what's
talks
about
the identification case. So this is here after the
well, I guess, yeah, counting. Are you?
Which
one? Oh, okay, so you've done.
I also had suggested that you take
a stock. I'd like to just think this program of mode identification and the progress of mode classification.
Okay.
Identification is
the. Yeah, there.
I was using the same word for both the theoretical side and the observational side. But certainly a mode classification, you know, even the radial node counting is obviously insufficient.
And that's like that's a famous problem.
It is.
It's existing for some years.
Well, dipole modes, at least, I think. Yes.
Yeah. So mode idea in a more general way than just rotational.
Yeah.
Higher order rotational effects, if I can use that, but also mixed character modes. And we all are stumbling upon mixed character modes in the giants and the subgiants and the subdwarfs, and the white dwarf, well, not so much anymore.
Returning to the theme of Ford modeling, this actually creates big problems if you want to do automated calculation of pulsation spectra. Because if you can't assign each mode a unique classification, you can't be sure that you haven't missed some stuff. Mm-hmm. And also, as you slowly change the parameters of a stellar model, you want to be able to track the same mode and see how it's affected. And not being able to identify the modes as you tweak these parameters and see how they change smoothly with, you know, whatever thing you're tweaking is a real problem. So this is a sort of this really does have a practical impact on automating forward modeling procedures.
Well, we all have our tricks. It might be a fun discussion to just disclose our tricks as to how we claim what the mode is that we're seeing is what we're claiming it is.
Well, we usually use the visibility arguments to.
Oh, you mean from the observational side?
Yeah.
I'm thinking from, even from the theoretical side.
Yeah, even for the fast rotators, it's much harder to figure out which, because the modes have, it's a combination of different harmonics.
Yeah.
That probably will end up, I talked about that with François Linier already, because the modes have, even though the modes are not well identified in the sense when there is no rotation, it's easy because you can separate L on N on as a different quantum numbers, you can still calculate for the case of the fast rotators the visibility for each mode, so you can somehow make selections based on this, which would be equivalent of saying that because we are observing a star with photometry, we only see like up to L equal to 2 or 3. It's the same kind of constraint you can use to.
But in terms of picking up radial orders.
You have no constraint then.
Right, especially if you don't see all radial orders.
Yeah.
But it's even problematic when looking at the output of a pulsation code.
Yeah.
So, it'd be an interesting kind of discussion, even from the non-rotating case. But then add the rotation, that's crazy.
Well, for beta safety stars, there's something that troubles me lately. And it's that the ones that have been studied from the ground, observed from the ground, for several of them, we have nice rotational splittings. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Well, you see nice splittings that you attribute to
rotation. We see nice splittings that fit very well with the rotational splitting, given the rotational frequency. But for the stars observed with coral, that we don't see any splittings. There are none. And I don't understand why.
None. The ground based or they're spectroscopic?
Both. And from.
And it's the same stars you're observing?
No, it's not the same stars. It's not the same stars.
Okay.
We don't have. There's no star observed with coral that has been observed from the ground.
Okay.
For long periods of time. It's building up.
But I don't understand why we don't see
them. The squirrel, the spinnings. And that's something that... Coral has to stop looking at pole on pulsing. All of them, yeah. So that's something that I think should be explained in some way. Is it a selection effect? Is it really something...
How many stars? What are we talking about?
A handful. Not many.
Okay, but still. And I think enough to be worried.
Yeah.
And how about for the ground? How many are additional?
Same numbers. I mean, we have
yeah.
Cool.
Maybe a lot of them. The one we have, like 10 stars, or maybe less than that with screens, but we have. And the ones that have been observed with long observing times, extended and they all show some splitting that can be very well explained with rotational splitting. And because they've been observed spectroscopically and photometrically, we have some mode identification for those modes, and so it fits very well with rotational splitting. not with the coral stars. So I'm puzzled by that.
Well, coral stars.
It's recorded.
and on camera too. Why did you say coral stars?
Because we see them in Kepler, I guess. So it can be we started seeing rotational splittings in Kepler. You have the SFE stars that you tell that? No, I was in general thinking about where it's special to
all the four. Oh,
yeah.
Kepler avoided any massive stars.
And so there are none in Kepler, so we can't compare.
We can't compare.
No.
There are no beta stars.
There should be.
No.
If they are, they're halo B stars. We don't know how many of those there are.
So.
Because if they were in the disk, they just take out a whole lot.
On the flip side of that, I did some work with John Monnier a year or two ago, using MOST to look at Russell Hay, Alpha Refuca. This is a delta scuti, but it's a very rapidly rotating one. And it appears to show modes in the G-mode part of the pulsation spectrum, which, okay, that's the first thing, which is... And then the second thing is that these G-modes have a completely uniform frequency space. And you think, well,
it's period space.
Period space. Yeah. That's better. And you think, well, hey, that's rotational splitting. But you think it's just, you think it might be tied into rotation.
No. Well, it depends if you're talking about period spacings or G modes that have equal splittings. I'm not following.
There's a.
So the G mode equal period space is simply the asymptotic of your G modes are independent of rotation.
Not when the star is rotating this rapidly.
Okay.
It completely
goofs.
If you try and understand it, even using first order mode splitting, you can't. I mean,
that's
and it's
assuming all the M's are present.
Yeah. But I mean, it is it is remarkable. This was mentioned at the IAU Symposium 272 in Paris, and I can't remember who it was, but somebody remarked that they'd seen a number of other stars like that.
Well, again in Granada, it was Catherine Federer talked about the results looking for the hybrid Delta Scuti and Gamma Doris stars, and she said basically they're all over. That there is no, they're not concentrated on the cool end of the Delta Scuti strip, but you see G-mode-like pulsations all over, which is a surprise. The discussion there was not quite definitive because the claim was that perhaps the position in the HR diagram wasn't adequately well determined, and that maybe with further ground-based follow-up of the Delta Scutis that showed gamma door pulsations but were hot would move them to cooler. So I guess the jury's still out on that. But yeah, there was also some discussion about rotation.
I remember it was uniform frequency spacing.
In the G-mode.
In the G-modes.
All right, we're running short of time. I do have a volunteer for Thursday at 11. Tomorrow at 10 is our first Astro PH coffee. If you go to the wiki, I could project it, but you can do it on your own. I've got a link to a paper on M-dwarf, a theoretical paper predicting M-dwarf pulsations driven by nuclear burning and convective bomb. And we'll talk about that. We need somebody to claim a paper for Thursday or for Friday. So whoever wants to do one, post it up on the coffee discussion page of the week. Claim that slot. And if nobody claims a slot by tomorrow, I will be out.
What else should we be adding to the wiki? Anything we want?
Anything you want. The only thing you can't access, unless you're an organizer, is the actual talks and discussions.
Okay.
Everything else, anybody can edit.
But we can upload movies and...
Sorry?
We can upload movies.
You can load movies on.
We can upload movies to the wiki.
You can do anything you want.
What do you have in mind?
It's
I'm not picking up any toys.